May it please the court, my name is John Levesque and I represent the defendant appellant Super Shuttle. There are two issues that I want to discuss today. The first is the issue of the sufficiency of the evidence to support the award of economic damages. And the second issue is the effect of a statement in a bankruptcy petition that was filed by the plaintiff. And the first thing I'd like to talk about is the economic damages. Now, as you know, the award was $130,000. And what we are arguing is that if you take a close look at the evidence that supports that, you just can't get to $130,000. So we have, in our brief, explained how if you credit the entire amount of the wage loss, and you we're not contesting that part of it, and you take that out of it, the amount that remains that has to be for medical expenses is not supported by the evidence. So if you take out the economic damages for wage loss, you're left with a number that has to be medical expenses of about $82,000. I'm going to use round numbers for the purpose of argument, but we have the exact numbers in the brief. There is support under the standard required for a compensable award of medical expenses for only $28,000. So that means that of that amount that has to be for medical bills, about $56,000 is not supported by the evidence. So what we have requested is that that award be set aside and reduced to the amount of $73,000, which is the amount that is supported by the evidence. That includes all the wage loss and the $28,000 in medical bills that are supported. Now, when I say supported by the evidence, the standard that I am relying on is the standard that has been the standard in Colorado for 50 years, which is medical bills to be compensable, medical expenses must be reasonable and necessary. The treatment must be reasonable and necessary. The bills must be reasonable and necessary. Now, we're not talking here about the issue of the reasonableness of the amount. What we're talking about is the necessity of the treatment. So the reasonableness under the recent Supreme Court cases and the recent cases talking about what is some evidence of the reasonable amount, that we are not relying on that part. What we're going on is what the necessity is.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Levesque?
Yes.
Are you conceding then that the amounts are reasonable and you're simply questioning the necessity issue?
Correct. We are conceding that there was some supporting evidence as to the reasonableness of the amount of that treatment. Okay. Now, if you just look at what the summary is, there's an exhibit. It's Exhibit 12. The medical bills themselves are not put into evidence. The only evidence that we've got as far as, you know, documentation is that one summary list, which is just a line-by-line by provider. And so when I say I'm conceding that, I have to concede that because under the case law, a person can say that this is an amount that was paid, that's some evidence of reasonableness. So under that standard, Mr. Hill said, you know, I owe this amount. So based on that, that's why we're not making that the issue. But let's look at the second component of that, which is a traditional component of damages law. Goes all the way back to the Kendall case, you know, in 1960, which is that the treatment has to be necessary. So there was no testimony, let me back up. There was testimony from two medical people, Dr. Almy, a chiropractor, Dr. Pitzer, the IME physician. Dr. Almy said that his treatment was 70% due to the accident, 30% related to pre-existing conditions. So his total bills on the chart were about $28,000. So based on his testimony that 70% of that was related to the accident, we're conceding that 70% of his bill was, based on his testimony, there's some evidence to say it was necessary. Now, Dr. Pitzer also said that the emergency room was $6,000, and the ambulance, not the ambulance, but the emergent care the day of the accident, that's another $6,000 or $7,000. Between the two of them, that's how you get to the figure that we're saying is supported by the evidence. Now, a big chunk of the medical bills was from a Dr. Haney. Dr. Almy and Dr. Pitzer both specifically said that that treatment didn't accomplish anything. So we are submitting that because Dr. Haney himself did not testify, and the medical people who did testify said that didn't cause any improvement, that's why we say that the bills for that treatment should not have been included, because there is no support in the record that that treatment was necessary.
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
Didn't Dr. Almy and the plaintiff both testify that the plaintiff experienced some relief from Dr. Haney's treatments?
Well, I don't think Dr. Almy said that, but the plaintiff did say that the treatment caused some limited short improvement, but he stopped going because it just was not effective. So I think if you look at the overall, what the plaintiff said, it was not doing him any good, so that he would continue it.
So if a treatment is attempted and it's not effective, it's therefore not compensable?
Correct. It's not necessary because it...
isn't it? Every treatment may not be effective in a particular instance. So is that really the law, that just because it's ineffective, it's therefore not compensable?
Well, I think that based on the fact that the two doctors said that it didn't cause any improvement, there's no support in any document that said that it was necessary. So I don't think it's enough for the plaintiff to say, I got some improvement on a limited basis, but it was not worth repeating, so I didn't do it. So I think that's our basis for saying
and that's for the stuff. Excuse me.
Go ahead.
For that part which he didn't continue with, he's not claiming any expense for, right? He stopped once he decided it was not.
I believe that's true, yes.
But attempting to get that relief, you're saying it's not compensable because it was not effective.
Correct. We submit that the plaintiff's testimony by itself is not sufficient to establish the necessity of that treatment.
How is that congruent, Mr. Lebsack, with the obligation to mitigate damages? If you're feeling significant pain and you do nothing for it, and you claim the pain and suffering at trial, the jury's going to get an instruction that the plaintiff has to minimize or mitigate the damages. And if you don't go see a pain person, you can't recover for that pain. But yet here, so here I'm not understanding the rationale. If you say he can't recover for the amount he spent trying to get better, doesn't that fly in the face of mitigation arguments?
Well, it may, except you'd have to have some basis for saying that this kind of a treatment would have been reasonable. So here, the people who testified, nobody said he should have gone to get this treatment because it was a reasonable thing to do. Even the person who was closest to the treatment, who was Dr. Almy, said that this treatment was not doing any good. Now, the testimony, as I recall in the record, was that the plaintiff went to see Dr. Haney because of a referral from his counsel. And Dr. Almy was the person who talked about that. So this is not a case where Dr. Almy said, I really think that treatment should have been, he should have tried to get that treatment. I see your point, that under the facts of this case, I don't think that there's a basis to say that we would have been, you know, trying to whipsaw the plaintiff into doing one thing or the other and getting the benefit of both. So I would like to change, unless there are other questions, I would like to change topics to the issue of this bankruptcy fact. This is a significant legal issue. Colorado case law has addressed judicial admissions in the context of civil lawsuits only. There are other judicial proceedings, obviously. Bankruptcy court is a judicial proceeding. There are no Colorado reported cases that have have applied the doctrine of judicial admission outside of the context of a civil lawsuit. So when you read the quotation of what a judicial admission is, you know, a formal deliberate declaration in which a party or his attorney makes makes in a judicial proceeding for the purpose of dispensing with proof of formal matters or of facts about which there's no real dispute. I mean, that phrase appears in all kinds of cases. That is a phrase that has been applied in Colorado because of the context of civil litigation. What we're arguing is that a statement in bankruptcy litigation is every bit as much a judicial admission as the statements that have been applied in Colorado cases.
Isn't the weight of the case law from outside the state, since there is no case law in the state, against you on this point, because it seems to require the judicial admission be in the same case?
I don't believe so. And the cases that we have cited, the federal cases, I admit that in those cases the judicial admission was applied in that same bankruptcy case. But I don't see why why the admission, if it qualifies as a judicial admission, why it could not be applied in not only in a very closely related manner. I mean, we're talking about a judicial admission in bankruptcy court that involved this specific case. So it's not an admission on some fact in another court that may tangentially relate to this case, but we're talking about an admission in bankruptcy court about this particular case, precisely this case. So we've cited three cases, all federal cases, which say that schedules filed in a bankruptcy case can be treated as judicial admissions. We think that the importance of this judicial admission was the context that the statement was made. It was a statement made by a debtor in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy trying to list what property he owned and what property was claimed as exempt from the bankruptcy estate. So, you know, it appeared in two places on the petition. One, here's my personal property. More importantly, it appeared on the list of property that the debtor claimed this is exempt from execution. And the statement there was that under a Colorado statute, personal injury claims are exempt from execution. But what the trustee immediately objected to was the overstatement. It doesn't apply to claims for medical expenses. And I'll give you the statute that's referred to in the bankruptcy petition itself, 1354.102, subpart N. So the statement, the trustee immediately objected, as soon as it came to his attention, that this personal injury claim includes things that are not protected by that statute. It includes medical expenses. And the trustee's objection said, I'm advised by the personal injury attorney, the medical expenses alone are $95,000. So this was a statement made as a bankruptcy filing for the purpose of advancing the debtor's interest in claiming exemption from the estate. Exemption from execution meaning that it's not going to be included in the bankruptcy estate. Now,
can I ask you a question about that?
Yes.
What was the significance of anything of the $10,000 figure? I mean, was it truly arbitrary, or was there some reason why the debtor would choose $10,000 rather than $25,000? I mean, did it benefit him in some way?
The only benefit that I believe is stated in the record, first of all, we don't know why the $10,000 figure was picked. I mean, there's nothing in the record that explains that. There's nothing, from the attorney explaining that. All I can say is that it was, the purpose of it was to justify to the court, the bankruptcy court and the trustee, that this is an asset that is exempt from execution, and there are reasons why you would induce a bankruptcy trustee not to be interested in an asset. Because if the asset appears to be something worthwhile, the bankruptcy trustee wants it for the estate. And so if you're trying to get something outside of the estate, the interest of the debtor is to say, hey, this is exempt, you don't get this. So if there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer, but I'd like to reserve my 30 seconds if it's okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Willhite. I'm the attorney for Mr. Hill. We believe that the verdict should not be disturbed, and in regards to the issues that were brought up, we'd like to discuss them. As you're aware from Super Shuttle's argument, that they are arguing that the treatment was not necessary and that Mr. Hill made a judicial admission. Now, the Kindle case was talked about. In the Kindle case, the plaintiff's testimony was evidence as to the amount paid and services rendered. Therefore, this would be admissible as it's some evidence of the reasonable value. Along with also the Lawson case, which has been briefed, in which we discussed that evidence needs not to be in the form of expert testimony. This is akin to the case that we have here at hand. The case at hand, Mr. Hill got up and testified to his treatments, what the treatments were, what kind of relief he had, and what he went through them, what he did with them. Now, he also talked about, as Super Shuttle's conceded, his medical bills and what he owed and what they were for. Mr. Hill was discussing each and every treatment. Now, as he said, he experienced some relief from the treatment regarding some of the injections. Defense counsel is now trying to talk about that Dr. Pitzer came in and said, well, I don't think this treatment was reasonable. Dr. Pitzer was a hired IME doctor by the defense to do a one-time examination. He was not a treating provider. Dr. Pitzer does not know what would help Mr. Hill and what would not. In fact, Dr. Pitzer said, yes, I saw Mr. Hill had some relief in some of the treatments, but I think that might have been some of the anesthesia. An individual can have whatever treatment they believe is reasonable and necessary. Some treatments work for some individuals, some don't for other individuals. This part here is a question of fact. This is more of a question that's for the jury. The jury has this. Some people, this is why when we present the jury instructions talk about that you can accept all, part, or none of the testimony from all the witnesses that came in. This is where the jury makes the decision. And the jury made the decision that they wanted to award $130,000 in economics, when in fact, the plaintiff, Mr. Hill, had asked for $157,328.83 in economics. So therefore, the jury did not accept all of the treatment for Mr. Hill. Now, I would like to move on then to the next issue.
Before you move on from that, Mr. Willard, let me ask you a couple questions. Did the plaintiff testify that he ceased going to see Dr. Haney because he wasn't experiencing relief, or did he testify that he stopped because he couldn't afford it, or some combination?
Your Honor, he did not think he was getting good enough relief. He felt like he was getting better relief through his chiropractic treatment. So while he was getting the injections, he was having injections up and down his spine, he didn't think that they were as good as getting the chiropractic relief, because Dr. Zach Olney is a doctor he had seen before, and he had had good relief. He was hoping to get quicker relief because Mr. Hill himself, his job by trade is a roofer, which is clearly a very physical job, being up on top of a roof. He was not able to be a roofer anymore as a result of these injuries, and he was hoping he could somehow get back faster so he could continue to get to work again. And he was not able to work during this time. He was hoping to experience a quick relief quicker, and he had heard these injections were going to help him faster. And they did provide some, but not the relief he was hoping for.
So I think, wasn't there some testimony that he was able to sit for a half hour, whereas before he wasn't able to sit for more than a minute or so?
Before the injection, he was not able to have, he was just having chiropractic. When he was experiencing some relief, and it, from what I remember, it was an extended period, and then he would kind of wax and wane. He would go back, and then he would have another round of injections. It would help out, then it wouldn't help as, then the pain would slowly come back. So he was experiencing some relief, but it was not full, complete, total relief that he was hoping for. And the fact that it was expensive for him to continue to get injections and go through, and he was worried of the financial responsibilities that would be incurred on him to continue injections. And Dr. Olney provided him chiropractic relief, which he felt was good enough for him at that time.
Okay, thank you. Is there anything in the record that indicates why he went to Dr. Haney? Who recommended that? Was that just his entirely his own decision, or was there a recommendation?
I believe he was actually recommended through the law firm, but I'm not completely sure if that Dr. Almy or the law firm.
Not in the record.
I'm not sure. Okay. If I may move on to the next section, which is the judicial admission. Now, as your honors know, a personal injury claim is always unknown and arbitrary until a settlement or a verdict is rendered. On Mr. Hill's schedules, which is part of the record which you've seen, Mr. Hill said that a personal injury claim said, quote, a personal injury claim from auto accident on September 19, 2007, by letter dated September 14, 2009, from debtor's personal injury counsel, the value of the claim is unknown. The claim has been arbitrarily valued at $10,000 for purposes of asserting the exemption on Schedule C. The personal injury counsel states the claim may continue for quite some time before resolving or may go to trial and believes that this case may go to trial.
Can I follow up on the question I asked you?
Yes.
Was there any significance at all to the $10,000 figure for purposes of the bankruptcy exception?
Not that we know of, Your Honor.
Your opponent makes the point that after the trustee initially asserted that the claim was worth more than $10,000, Mr. Hill continued to assert that it was worth only $10,000. Why stick to $10,000 if it's not relevant to the bankruptcy proceeding?
I believe, Your Honor, that he claimed this on the Schedule C, which is an exemption, and if anything was worth it, from what I believe is that the bankruptcy attorney just did not know what the claim was worth, because unfortunately at that time there's no one knows what the claim is worth. No one knows what the value of the personal injury claim is. So the bankruptcy attorney, for his purposes of filling out the paperwork, apparently put in $10,000. There's no known from Mr. Hill or us as the personal injury attorneys of any reason to claim that.
Okay, thank you.
As far as the cases, the Gordon case talks about judicial admissions, which was talked about. There are formal, deliberate declarations which a party or his attorney makes in judicial proceedings for the purposes of dispersing with proof of formal matters or facts which there's no real dispute. There's been a dispute the entire time. Economics and non-economics have always been in dispute in this matter. Mr. Hill, in fact, testified at his creditor's hearing. He testified that he did not know the value of the claim. The bankruptcy attorney did not know the value of the claim. The value of the claim was unknown and arbitrary and was not known until there was a verdict that was rendered or a settlement. Now, the Horton case specifically talked about the language of a party or the attorney should be construed in the view of the purpose for which it is used, and in connection with the surrounding circumstances and statements. But going back to the Gordon case also said that the use of the words probability and possibility are words of uncertainty. And then in addition, which we've talked about, the Salazar case said that it must be clear and unambiguous. There is no doubt or misunderstanding. And evidence must be viewed in light that's most favorable to the plaintiff. Now, this case has always been in dispute. The defense filed, Super Shuttle filed their statutory offer, and that was $15,000. That is what they valued the case at. They thought the case was valued at that. The plaintiff, on the other hand, at trial, asked for $247,328.83. That is what Mr. Hill asked for. The jury, they came back with a verdict of $190,000. Obviously, the jury disputed with what the plaintiff valued and what the Super Shuttle valued. Therefore, this was an unknown value until the verdict was reached on August 4th. Now, Super Shuttle is here saying that they want you to believe that every case in which a person files a bankruptcy claim prior to the resolution of their personal injury claim, that what they put on their schedule is the value of the claim. Therefore, if Mr. Hill would have sat here and valued his case at $500,000, then Super Shuttle would have said, this is what the value of the case is. And I don't believe that is the result that they are wanting.
You think Super Shuttle would have confessed judgment if he had asked for half a million?
And that's what exactly what they're asking. They're saying he confessed judgment with $10,000. So if he would have put $500,000, that would have been the same situation. They're trying to sit there.
But the judicial admission applies only against your client. It can't be used as an offensive sword, right?
Well, that is true. But if they had said that, we would have brought that up, and we wouldn't have had the same situation. We would have attempted to use that. Now,
can I ask you a quick question about the judicial admission doctrine? There was some discussion during your opponent's oral argument about whether judicial admission doctrine can be used in the separate case from the case in which the admission was made.
Right.
Do you have an opinion on that? And if you think it's limited or to the same case in which the admission is made, why do you think that should be the rule?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that it should. First off, his personal injury is a whole separate. His bankruptcy is a whole separate situation. His bankruptcy is a whole different case, and it's not the personal injury case. And it shouldn't be used against him because at the time when this $10,000 was written down, he did not know what the claim of the value of the claim is. You're able to put a value on what a house is, but you can't put a value on a personal injury claim. And it shouldn't be used against him because Mr. Hill does not know what the claim is worth. He has no idea what the claim is worth. And again, he has to go to a jury and or reach a settlement with Super Shuttle to decide what the value of the case is. Therefore, it should not be used against him, and there's no reason it should be used against him because this was in a separate proceeding for something completely separate that has that was not relevant to what Super Shuttle, the act that Super Shuttle committed against him.
Okay, but I assume for the moment that we agree that it's an entirely separate proceeding.
Mm-hmm.
Why should judicial admissions be limited to the proceeding in which they're made?
Because in the proceeding that they're made, it should be based around what the context of. Going back to the Horton case, in which that specifically says, the language of a party or attorney should be construed in the view of the purpose for which it's used in this connection with the connection with the surrounding circumstances and state. And that's what the judicial submission should be used for, that situation. This is, again, a situation where this case was given over to the bankruptcy, but however, the bankruptcy ended up abandoning the claim so Mr. Hill could proceed. So the bankruptcy knew that Mr. Hill was proceeding his case to trial. They had agreed to turn over the case to him so he had proper standing, so he could proceed against it. This should not be construed to be used against him because the bankruptcy wouldn't abandon that claim against him.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Now, as I said, that the schedule, again, this was an arbitrary number that was put on here and that was used for him, that was used by Mr. Hill. Now, again, he did not know the value of the claim and that was unknown. So again, this was an arbitrary number that was put down and that was not used for any purpose. Again, we request that you do not disturb what the verdict is. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to respond briefly on this point of the significance of the bankruptcy filing. The bankruptcy filing was filed with the court on June 28th of 2011. And this is in the supplemental record at page 365. That was after the trustee had already raised his objections, after we had moved for summary judgment based on the significance of that bankruptcy filing, at a time when Mr. Hill was represented both by personal injury counsel and bankruptcy counsel. And if there's anything that I know plaintiff's counsel are experts at, it is knowing not to understate a number of a case. So if there's any reason, may I finish my
yes.
sentence? If there's any reason to come up with a underestimate by a plaintiff, I don't know what it is. It's easy to overstate a large number in a filing like this. Why a lower number is, there's no incentive to put a lower number there. Thank you.
Can I ask this one?
Yes.
Did this filing come after the settlement offer of $15,000?
I think it was made shortly before. If I'm recalling our settlement offer, $15,000, I think that was made in July. And
okay.
This was before that.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments this morning, or this afternoon, rather. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.